Good morning. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate the opportunity to present argument before this honorable court. The appeal that the court is faced with today provides you with multiple opportunities to reverse and remand the trial court's judgment granting the appellee's summary judgment on appellant's claim, Mr. Kilpatrick's claims. And as the court is well aware, there are many issues that were briefed, many issues that were raised by both sides, and numerous cases cited in the pleadings. So in the interest of trying to direct the argument and kind of distill it to the main points, I'm going to start with the discussion on whether or not there was evidence raising a fact issue regarding the existence of an informal fiduciary relationship between the appellant and appellees at the time they entered into the settlement agreement, which is one of the subjects of this underlying lawsuit and appeal. As this court is no doubt aware, Texas law allows the imposition of an informal fiduciary relationship in certain instances when one party views the other party in a manner that that party relies on and places trust in the other party. And the case law that was cited by both sides in this appeal address the situation from the perspective of the person who is putting the trust in, the reliance on the other party. It doesn't suggest that it is mutual. It suggests that it's viewed from the standpoint of the person who is placing the trust, placing the reliance. Now, in addition to that case law, and it's cited by both parties, Crim Truck and Tractor Company versus Navstar, it's 823 Southwest 2nd, 591. The person placing the reliance is justified in doing so if that person is accustomed to being guided by the judgment or advice of the other party, and there exists a long association in a business relationship and a personal one. Now, before I talk about the relevant facts that were before the court when it ruled in favor of appellees on summary judgment, I think it's important to note that the majority of the cases cited by both appellant and appellees on this issue concerning the existence of a fiduciary relationship, the majority of those cases address an appeal from a jury verdict or from a judgment that a court entered either on the verdict or notwithstanding the verdict. In the vast majority of the cases cited and before this court in the briefing, the appellant was afforded the opportunity to have a jury of his or her peers weigh the evidence, determine the credibility of the evidence, and make a ruling as to whether or not there was sufficient evidence to support the imposition of an informal fiduciary relationship. And on that point, I think the case of Heron v. Medical Protective Company, that's 89 Southwest 3rd, 301, and it's cited in appellant's brief, I think that case is informative because the court, the Texarkana Court of Appeals, considered a trial court's grant of summary judgment in favor of the appellee in that case, the defendant, and looked at and distinguished the Texarkana court's prior ruling in Crim Truck, which was ultimately affirmed by the Texas Supreme Court. In Heron, the court noted that the difference between the two cases, its earlier ruling in approximately 1992 and then its ruling in Heron, which was 2002, the difference was that in Crim Truck, the appellant had the opportunity to present the facts and evidence to a jury and have a jury determine whether or not there was evidence sufficient to find that imposing an informal fiduciary relationship. In Heron, the court specifically said that the appellant was not afforded that opportunity. And it went on to say that in cases where the issue is whether or not there's an informal fiduciary relationship, it's a very fact-intensive inquiry. And it's reserved for the trier of fact to make a determination. Respectfully, with all due respect to the trial court, Mr. Kilpatrick was not given that opportunity, and he should have been. We believe that the evidence that was before the trial court did raise a fact issue with regards to the existence of a fiduciary relationship at the time the parties executed the relevant settlement agreement. The evidence that was before the court showed that, clearly from the style of the case, the parties are related, they're brothers. They spent years working in a family-owned and run company. In addition to that, they were partners in various partnerships. They were members in limited liability companies.
Wasn't the case law that was provided to this court, and I think the applicable case law, doesn't that establish that an informal fiduciary relationship can be established only if there's no prior history of betrayal? I mean, you jump in one part of your brief talking about how horribly your client was treated, abused, physically abused, emotionally abused, lied to, habitually lied to, not just once, but time and time again. And then you jump to the second part, but we trusted him and we had this long history of this family relationship and I relied on him, but they lied to me and I think they're horrible people, but I trusted them. I mean, you've got to pick a position. And I think the case law says if there's prior betrayal, then perhaps the court can find the lack of an informal fiduciary relationship.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think just to address the points you raised, I do think that it is possible for a court to make the decision and to make the determination on certain facts. But the facts of this case show that the abuse, the things that are cited that happened and occurred in the past were focused around the 1997 sale documents, which was discussed by both sides. At that time, and again, the view is viewed from the person who is in, you know, who is in the standpoint of saying that there was an informal fiduciary relationship. At that time, Mr. Kilpatrick's older brothers were treating him poorly. I think that's in the record. The court cited to it. That does not say that they did not have a prior fiduciary relationship, or that them treating him poorly in terms of, you know, physically or verbally saying things to him or demeaning him, that in and of itself is enough to destroy the fiduciary relationship that existed prior to that time, a lifetime of a relationship. I think the evidence suggests that Mr. Kilpatrick certainly was hurt by the statements. The evidence before the court shows that he did not want, and it's specifically said in the record, he did not want, even despite their statements and words to him, their actions towards him in connection with 1997, he did not want to sell his shares in the family company. That suggests that he would have continued to be with them, continued to preserve the relationship that they did have. Now, ultimately, we know that he did sell his shares in 1997, and that the parties had contact at family gatherings from 1997 to 2001. The facts that suggest the imposition of an informal fiduciary relationship here are really critical in 2001. As the court's aware, a lawsuit was filed in the fall, in September of 2001, and it was.
So, if your client had been put on the stand and asked, "Mr. Kilpatrick, do you trust your brothers?" he would have said yes. And then opposing counsel would have turned around and said, "Yes, but you're accusing them for fraud. So, if you trust them, obviously they wouldn't have defrauded you, would they?" And how would your client have answered that question?
Your Honor, if you would have asked him, or if a court would have asked him that in September of 2001 when the lawsuit was filed, then I think that it would be disingenuous to say that he would affirmatively and unequivocally say, "Oh, I trust them."
Okay. But is it in 2001 that we're concerned about when the fiduciary relationship existed?
Yes, Your Honor, because within a month and a half of filing the lawsuit, the family, not only the appellees, but also other family members, started discussing the filing of the lawsuit with and urging him to let bygones be bygones, essentially, to basically come back. Let us have the family relationship that we're meant to have. You are right. We're going to come clean with you and tell you exactly what happened. And that's why within a couple of months of filing the lawsuit, the parties had settled. It wasn't a long and drawn-out litigation. It was merely filing, and the parties met informally, apart from counsel, and well, with the exception of one attorney that ended up being there at the Colonial Country Club meeting, as cited in the brief. But the parties discussed things that suggested, and not only suggested, but you know, the undisputed evidence at the trial record was that appellees represented to Mr. Kilpatrick that he could trust them, that they had
it's
done
not
wrong
from
to
their
him.
Standpoint, as you've pointed out to us.
Yes, Your Honor,
and his standpoint.
And the point being that when you consider a lifetime relationship
of fraud, of abuse, of physical altercations, of misleading, of wanting to get you out of the business, of a continuing relationship of that nature, which I believe is that's what's in the record.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think what's in the record addresses the circumstances around 1997 when the parties were running the company together. It does not, respectfully, it does not address the lifetime of brothers who grew up together, lived together, and had a relationship prior to and apart from the facts that specifically address the 1997 sale.
So how do you get around the cases that say if there's a prior history of betrayal, that negates an informal fiduciary relationship?
Your Honor, from my understanding, I think that is evidence that a court can consider. I don't think that it automatically negates it, because I think that it's a fact-intensive inquiry that has to be decided on a case-by-case basis. When you have a situation as here, where there's a lifetime relationship between parties, I think the case law suggests that the fiduciary duty and the relationship specifically can be reinvigorated, so to speak, because we all know in the family setting there are opportunities, there are times when relationships are in a poor state, and relationship when reconciliation occurs. And so I think that if the facts support that there's reconciliation being involved and one party trusts that the other parties who are basically suggesting and stating flat out that reconciliation is occurring, I think that the case law would support at least a fact finder having the opportunity to determine that there is a fiduciary relationship.
Can you address race judicata while you have just a couple minutes?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. It's interesting. First off, the race judicata, as set forth in appellant's brief, would potentially apply to the claims that were asserted in the 2001 lawsuit. Those claims addressing the sale and among other things, the sale of Berry of Pescor to Berry in 2001, and the buyout of appellant in 1997. The reason that appellant dismissed those claims with prejudice after a 2 month long lawsuit, essentially, within months of filing that lawsuit in 2001. The reason, and it's cited by both parties in their briefing, is because that the parties entered into the settlement agreement in 2001, which appellant has put forth evidence to the trial court and to this court in the record that 2001 settlement agreement was procured by fraud. Now, if it was procured by fraud, then it's appellant's position that the underlying, you know, obligation that appellant had to dismiss the claims with prejudice was also procured by fraud and was the result of fraud by the appellees.
Fraud,
and so
fiduciary duty, they defrauded me, but we're in a fiduciary relationship.
Your Honor, it's after the fact, after entering into the settlement agreement, after dismissing the claims with prejudice, after the fact, appellant learned that there was evidence suggesting fraud, showing fraud in connection with them inducing him into entering into the settlement agreement, Your Honor, and also breaches of that fiduciary duty and the fiduciary relationship that was in place at that time. It appears I'm out of time, Your Honor. I thank you for your opportunity for the opportunity to present this argument to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Mr. Warren.
May it please this court. My name is Bill Warren, and I represent the defendants, Kevin and Tim Kilpatrick. I want to pick up where the Mr. Simmons began, which was whether or not there's an informal fiduciary duty or any evidence of an informal fiduciary duty in the record. I want to begin by stating or reciting from Schlumberger. Schlumberger is clear that at the time the alleged breach of fiduciary duty occurs, there must be a fiduciary duty going into that event. Here, there must have been a fiduciary duty that occurred or that was present at the time this meeting occurred in 2001. As Justice McCoy and Justice Gabriel have talked about, the time period leading up to that, by the plaintiff's own admissions, by his admissions in both depositions taken in 2001 and in his affidavit testimony provided in 2011, the parties were involved in a history that was tortuous at best. According to Kelly, he was physically threatened. He was verbally abused. He had bad jokes played on him. He had his desk removed. He had keys, the locks changed while he worked with the defendants. And that ultimately culminated in 1997 by him being physically and verbally pushed into selling stock in the company that he did not want to sell. He then says that in 1997, as a result of that sale, he was defrauded. He says he was defrauded by the defendants in that sale because they switched the document on him. The first document that he was told he was signing had a one-year participation in profits, and then, or had a full, had a participation profits at any time that PestCorp was later sold. But the one that was switched on him had a one-year restriction. He discovers that in 2001. He goes out and hires Carrington Coleman, a noted law firm in Dallas, to file a lawsuit that alleges every type of fraud imaginable and available under state of Texas law, and claims that these guys, after all these years of abuse, defrauded him. At that point in time, clearly there is no evidence of an informal fiduciary duty existing among these parties, and there's certainly no basis for imposing a legal one. He then says in his affidavit within a month and a half that his mother contacted him and said, "Kelly, I want us to be a family again." He then goes and meets with Kevin and Tim at the Colonial Country Club. He says going into the meeting, he was told no loggers would be there. He shows up and there is one, according to Kelly. So we have a period that, according to Mr. Kilpatrick, the plaintiff, is nothing but one misstatement after another luring him into this meeting. And then he shows up and all of a sudden there's a fiduciary duty that he says exists. That's just not right under Schlumberger. Schlumberger says that there has to be a fiduciary duty that exists leading up until that time. There is no evidence of such a duty existing in this case. Now, with respect to Kremtruck versus Navistar, Mr. Simmons discussed it. And it is true that they talk in some of the cases, well, you have to consider the subjective intent or the subjective feeling of the person claiming the fiduciary duty. Well, Kremtruck also says that the subjective belief of the party claiming it is not enough. And that's really the only thing he has here. Now, candidly, I think it stretches the imagination to say that someone who has endured everything that Mr. Kilpatrick has says he's endured at the hands of my clients for years would walk into this meeting feeling trust and confidence. But if that's what he says, the Supreme Court has held that is simply not enough to create a fiduciary duty. I want to talk briefly about the disclaimer of reliance. The disclaimer of reliance is in the record, obviously, and it's important to note that there's two parts to that disclaimer of reliance. There's a paragraph 23 and a paragraph 24 to that settlement agreement. I'm talking, of course, about the 2001 settlement agreement. Paragraph 23 says Mr. Kelly warns and agrees, as do my clients, that we are not relying on anything the other person said that is material to our decision to enter this agreement. We are not going to rely on what came out of their mouths. Paragraph 24 comes at it from the other way, and this, I believe, also impacts the fiduciary duty. There the parties agree we are not going to rely on any duty that the other party may or may not have to disclose a fact. So both parties agree that they're not only relying on what was said, they're relying that the other part on the fact that the other party has no duty to disclose anything.
Was the 10Q provided in connection with this litigation?
The 10Q was provided, Your
Honor. Does the 10Q reveal the sales price?
It does. If you look at the...
Did you offer an explanation for the circumstantial evidence that there was more assets there later on here in 2010 or wherever than one would suspect came from the 10Q sales price?
No, Your Honor, candidly, we did not. And the reason is we filed a motion, our motion for summary judgment, and response is when we get the notion, well, there's more, that these guys received more than they said they
did.
I'm
just asking, is there evidence in the record that explains those circumstances?
If I understand your question correctly, let me go at it this way. Mr. Kilpatrick says, and in the meeting, Mr. Kelly Kilpatrick says that in the meeting in 2001, Kevin and Tim told him that they each received $1 million. If you look at the reply brief, it actually says they represent they've received $3 million. And in fact, the $3 million is what's on that handwritten note that they've offered into evidence. In the 10Q, which contains the entire sale agreement, it's not a description, it contains the sale agreement between BPC and the defendants. It says that $12 million in cash would be paid, minus debt, and it runs through the types of debt, and ultimately, and at the bottom of that, it says that debt, that after the debt is paid, that there will be $3.5 million paid to the defendants, and it's capped at that $12 million. The actual cash payment is capped at $3.5 million. In addition to that, it also says that the defendants will receive shares in five different series of Class C stock. And I think that's an important point, and it goes back to what Mr. Kilpatrick, the plaintiff, should have known that he was getting. Because in the settlement agreement, Justice McCoy, it says that he receives cash, but the $500,000 he received in settlement in 2001 wasn't cash. It was pieces, it was carve-out stock from the five different series that my clients had received from BPC in the sale. And if you look, if you compare the numbers, he received exactly 5% of every series of stock that my clients received from the purchase. So does the record reflect an understanding as to where this $3 million he claims came from? I believe it came from the cash payment that you see that's reflected within the sale agreement that he had. But then he also not only received $50,000 to $60,000 in cash, he received a 5% carve-out of each series of stock that my clients received. And the sale agreement also, he comes in today and says, well, they misrepresented. They didn't tell me they were receiving so much more. If you look at the sale agreement, which he had, in which he had a very good law firm representing him, and according to Mr. Kilpatrick, explaining to him what this meant, it shows exactly how much stock was paid from the BPC stock that was given to my clients in exchange for their stock in PESCOR. It shows exactly the number of every series of stock in the settlement agreement that with Mr. Kilpatrick shows exactly what he received out of each of those.
Can I assume that discovery in that case went forward as to this also?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Can I assume that discovery went forward as to this question during the 2001 litigation?
In the 2001, it did with respect to Don Kilpatrick. Kelly Kilpatrick settled out in December 2001, roughly 2 months after the lawsuit was filed. His brother, notably, refused to settle out. And that litigation continued on, in fact, I think through 2007. Ultimately, there was a summary judgment granted in that one by Judge in Parker County. I can't recall his name.
Quisenberry?
No, the other one. They just retired. Cressman, Judge Cressman, that this court affirmed in an opinion I believe it was in 2007. In fact, Justice McCoy, I believe you may have sat on that panel. So going back to the point also, and I think that raises the issue, did he have the right or the ability to discover what was going on with respect to the limitations issue?
At the 2001 meeting at the Country Club, it's been said that that there was an attorney there, but
yes,
it was not Kelly Kilpatrick's attorney. Yet you've indicated he did have an attorney before entering an Edelman agreement.
To the in September 2001, Mr. Kilpatrick and his brother Don Kilpatrick, the original plaintiffs, hired Carrington Coleman. In fact, the lawyer that they retained was Russell Nelms, who's now the bankruptcy judge. Russell Nelms filed a very lengthy petition that's in the record alleging every type of fraud available against the defendants. According to Kelly, his mother called him and repeatedly and said, I want us to be a family again. Please meet with Kevin and Tim. And he goes to the Colonial Country Club to meet with them one-on-one. They had a business lawyer there, according to Kelly, Mr. William Dismuke, they being my clients. There were no litigation lawyers there. It's in the record. So did he have a lawyer? Yes, he did. The lawyer was not at that meeting. Now, but I want to point out, as they note, as Mr. Kilpatrick notes in his reply brief, the settlement agreement itself was signed many days, in fact, I believe the quote is, if not weeks, after that meeting. If you read the settlement agreement, it says repeatedly that Kelly Kilpatrick relied on his lawyer and the advice and counsel of his lawyer in entering into and signing that document. In fact, it says affirmatively, again, we're not relying on what they said, but we have met with our lawyer, and we are relying on his advice and counsel in signing this document. Now, they make the notion that even if there is a clear and unequivocal disclaimer of reliance, moving back to that issue, that the factors in Forest Oil that must be met are not established by the record. Those factors are, one, that he was represented by counsel. As I've just pointed out, he had counsel, and in fact represented in the settlement agreement that they had read it and reviewed it with him. Secondly, it has to be that the issue later addressed, that the topic of the dispute must have been discussed. Here, the topic of the dispute now was discussed. The topic of the dispute now is, what did my clients get? If you look at this settlement agreement again, it shows that they received, that they gave to Kelly pieces of exactly what they received, cash and pieces of the stock. In fact, Kelly admits in his affidavit, what we talked about was money. Well, that's exactly what's at issue in this lawsuit, money. How much does he get paid? They also say, well, the third element is, was this an arm's length transaction? I think I believe it's the 14th Court of Appeals opinion in McLernan versus Dynegy is very important on that point. In that case, the Houston Court of Appeals said that there was evidence, and in fact established that as a matter of law, that there was an arm's length transaction, because in the agreement at issue itself, it said that the parties had the ability to contact a lawyer, they were given an adequate time to review the document before they signed it, and that they were entering the document willfully and knowingly. All three of those clauses were in the settlement agreement here. So there is without question that it is without question established that this was an arm's length transaction. And finally, you have to show that there was that the plaintiff was knowledgeable in business matters. It's interesting that the argument that Mr. Kilpatrick, the plaintiff, makes on this point is, well, Kelly was not sufficiently knowledgeable to interpret a complex legal document. Well, if you have to beat that element by showing that you can read a legal document, then that makes the whole point about having a lawyer, the first element, moot. The question is whether he was not, to use the words in Forrest Oil, knowledgeable in business matters. Mr. Kilpatrick is a graduate of TCU. According to his affidavit, he rose to be the vice president of operations in the family business. He was a member of the board of directors for 8 to 9 years, and at the time his deposition was taken in 2001, he was the owner of KMK Capital, his own business. He was a man who was knowledgeable in business matters. Finally, with respect to limitations, I just want to hit on it very quickly. They have alleged that their delay in filing the lawsuit from 2001 to 2010 is justified under either the discovery rule or fraudulent concealment. I think both of the Supreme Court's decisions on both of those points can be distilled down as far as our approach to it, that if the plaintiff is put on notice that there may, that he may have a claim, he's not excused in not pursuing it or at least diligently trying to discover facts. At the time in 2001, when he signed this document, he had the 10K. That 10K had the purchase agreement. It showed exactly what my clients had paid and then what it received. And then 3 months later, he gave his deposition, and this is in the record, in the remaining case that his brother had brought. In that case, he admits, and again, this part's in the record, that he had been told by Carrington Coleman before signing the agreement that his stock that he was suing over, he had allegedly been defrauded out of, was worth $4 to $5 million, and that his claim was as good for 3 to 17 times that much. Obviously, he was aware of facts that should have made him pursue an investigation. Unless the court has any questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. All right, Mr. Simmons, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors, and thank you, Mr. Warren. Your Honor, just to add some more context to this discussion about the 10-Q, it is correct, and the evidence supports, that at the 2001 meeting at Colonial Country Club, the 10-Q was known by Mr. Kelly Kilpatrick.
Known and handled.
And handled. And also, at that meeting, and this is in the record at specifically a clerk's record at 367, at that meeting, Appellee Mr. Tim Kilpatrick handwrote notes explaining to Mr. Kelly Kilpatrick exactly what the disposition of the purchase price, as Mr. Warren alluded to, what that ultimately boiled down to in terms of value and money received by Appellees. And as we discuss in our briefing, the Appellees represented that, yeah, that's the purchase price, but it doesn't account for all the debt that we had to pay off. And when you take away all the debt, we're left with $1 million apiece. You received $500,000 for your shares in 1997, so you get $500,000 more. We want to bring you even and do the right thing. Again, brothers, lived together, grown up together. Mr. Kilpatrick, Kelly Kilpatrick, believed what they were telling him at the time was true. Multiple representations, and Mr. Warren discussed the fact that their mother, Mrs. Kilpatrick, was reaching out to Kelly Kilpatrick, encouraging him to settle, to be a family again. The record shows that the Appellees were also reaching out to Mr. Kilpatrick.
You've referenced mom several times, and I'm hearing that. I read it. What does that have to do with the fiduciary relationship between he and his brothers? I'm hearing you about mom and son. Got that. Do this. But that's not the fiduciary relationship between brothers.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it sets the stage, and it's just it's some more context for how Mr. Kilpatrick, when he went to this meeting at Colonial Country Club, in addition to the attempts that Appellees were reaching out to him and telling him prior to the meeting to settle, that we want to be a family again. It explains that when he arrived at that meeting, that his mindset was there for the purposes of reconciliation. That's what not only Appellees had said to him, but their own mother. And so I think it's just setting the stage. It does not show that you know there's a fiduciary relationship. I agree with the court. But what it does do is it provides additional context for how it would be justified and reasonable for Mr. Kilpatrick to believe at that time, based on the representations that they made, that they were acting in his best interest, as they repeatedly said to him. Now, with regards to the disclaimer of reliance, in the brief amount of time I have left, we don't believe that it meets the forest oil factors, and I think Allen v. Devon Energy is informative on that point. In that case, the appellant, Mr. Allen, was an attorney, an oil and gas attorney. It concerned an oil and gas sale. And in spite of those facts, the Court of Appeals in Houston still held that the disclaimer of reliance in that case failed to meet and satisfy the requirements under Forest Oil. as I discussed earlier, if there is evidence raising a fact issue of a fiduciary relationship, then that would also impact the disclaimer of reliance and the enforceability of same. It would also impact the statute of limitations and tolling, given the fact that if there was evidence that there was a fiduciary relationship, that that could operate to toll limitations. Going back to the meeting at Colonial Country Club and the discussions the appellees had with appellant concerning the disposition of assets resulting from that the Berry sale, we believe that there was evidence raising a fact issue as to fraudulent concealment. Given that there were affirmative misrepresentations, the evidence shows, by appellees concerning the dispositions of the Berry sale, so that despite the existence of a 10Q, which is a an intense document that is very dense and does not specifically itemize and list out the disposition of the proceeds as to paying off the debts, that given the representations that were made by appellees at that meeting, we believe that there was evidence supporting a fraudulent concealment.
So basically what you're telling us is that they duped Kelly and they duped the Carrington Coleman law firm, a very sophisticated law firm, which later recounted in these documents they relied on the lawyers, the very sophisticated Carrington Coleman lawyers, not the representation of the brothers.
Your Honor, just briefly, I know I'm out of time, to answer your question. I think what you're talking about is the $4.5 million valuation that was addressed by Mr. Warren.
Or any representations made in these documents which were in the possession of, clearly gone over and clearly understood by Carrington Coleman and explained to their client.
Well, Your Honor, the just with regards to that, I agree that the documents say what they say. With regards to the $4.5 million valuation, that was Carrington Coleman's attempt, just looking at the baseline, looking at the sales price and saying, here's basically a third, this is what your stocks would be worth, that did not address the disposition of the payments to pay off the debts, et cetera, and the $1 million. But I agree with Your Honor that the documents do say what they say.
Thank you.
Thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons, and thank you, Mr. Warren. We appreciate you all being here. We appreciate your briefing and your arguments today. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. We will take a short recess and take up the 10:30 docket in a few minutes.